riskiest First Friday I've given you, because it's actually, it's more looking at aspects of the psychology of love. However, I don't want to excuse that, but I don't think it needs excusing, because as you know, the spiritual life isn't something separate from the rest of our life. The spiritual life means, doesn't it, the life of the Spirit in us. So it affects our bodily life, our sexual life, our emotional life, our mental life. It's every aspect of us. And the grace of Christianity is to transform every single part of us. Our feelings, our emotions, our fears, our hopes, our desires, our joys, our bodily reactions, our face, our eyes, every part is transformed by grace. So to look at some aspects of the psychology of loving with a view perhaps to moving into a more ethereal area next month, I think has some value. So for what it's worth, I'm going to present some ideas. They're strongly based on a book which I once found helpful and probably would again, called The Road Less Travelled, which was a very popular book, and I think it's good that it was popular, written by a Christian psychiatrist in America. And Scott Peck was his name, or M. Scott Peck. So I'll be presenting some of his ideas as I've filtered them through my own person. Just because we're talking about how do you actually really love one another. And we're asked to do it, we're graced to do it, Jesus says do it. Let's look at some aspects, and if they don't make sense to you, they're probably wrong. But you just take them in, see what, if any of it makes sense, and it might help your prayer. Scott Peck begins his book, The Road Less Travelled, with words something like, I don't have a copy of it here, so I'm going on rather a long memory and notes. He begins, I think the first sentence is something like, it's an improvement on Fraser's remark, life is difficult. Life's not meant to be easy, wasn't that the... Well, life, positively, is difficult. Those who don't find life difficult may leave the room immediately. That'll save you going through the rest of this hour. And his point is that if we accept that, then all these strange and not very well-founded longings that we have for this life might suddenly be put into place and we might be able to get on with it. Otherwise, we keep chasing a rainbow that never seems to land. So he goes on for the first, well, 60 pages or so of his book to make the point that if we're ever going to learn to love, we need to learn discipline. Discipline meaning an organization of life, a not following every whim and feeling and desire and hurt and so on. We have to learn something of that. So we'll spend a few minutes looking at that. You check this for yourself. Life presents problems which cause painful feelings. We all know that. So what do we do when we get painful feelings? I don't want to make a big difference between the sexes here because I'm a man and I only know much about what men do and we're in the minority here. But if other men are anything like me, we try to avoid them. Who wants crook feelings? And since we don't have to have babies, we don't have that crook feeling forced upon us. So men tend to shy away from pain. I probably women do too, but you haven't got as much chance as we have, perhaps. But whatever about all that, I try to avoid such feelings. I don't like them. But there is an alternative. Because feelings are always friendly, as they say, don't they? Feelings are always telling you something true. What we do with them is another point, but they're always a sign, a red or green light, letting you know that something's happening and they need to be taken really, really, really seriously. So we can accept these feelings in relationships. and then face them and try to see what to do with them. Not either deny them or repress them or avoid them. And if we're going to resolve a feeling or know what to do with it, this author suggests, and it seems true to me, that we have to be ready to delay gratification. I guess we're talking about our children as much as ourselves at the moment, but let's stay with ourselves. We have to learn to delay gratification. To attend to problems, he says, that is, to face painful feelings rather than indulge in an impatient reaction and just let the feeling out and act on it and express it, which is rarely sensible. Or, rather than do nothing in the hope that it'll go away, if we're going to attend to the problem that's facing us and to the feeling that lets us know that we're not at peace with the situation, it's not resolved, and I think this is awfully true, this, we need to feel secure about the future. Because it involves putting off pleasure till the problem is solved. I wonder whether today, among the young, and I don't mean not us, but particularly, I wonder if this is a major problem in our community, that security about the future is very difficult to find, particularly for the young. Whereas I think in my case, just to speak personally for a moment, I think I had an absolutely secure family. And that was as much fortune and grace as anything else, but it's a fact. So I suppose I had was given, and perhaps a lot of us were given, but not all of us were given it, a kind of sense that everything was all right, really, no matter what went really wrong, basically things were right. Mum would always be there, let's put it that way. Something like that. It's a great gift, isn't it? And a great gift that you mums and dads have given your kids. So there's something about the security of the future, because if the future isn't secure, well, you might be tempted to act on feelings now and be gratified now. So some sense of faith, for us it's a faith sense, but also an experiential sense that you belong in the world and the world is okay to be in, and that this moment doesn't have to take over everything, might enable me or you to live with awful and painful feelings and wait. To attend to difficult relationships in love, see if this makes sense to you, we need to feel valued as a person. And that's given us by the people who wasted time with us when we were babies and cared for us when we were young and had time to do it. And, of course, the emotional ability to do it and the health to do it and all that. And we weren't all gifted like that. I guess all our mums and dads loved us as well as they could, but sometimes they weren't capable of giving much love, just as we're not at times. So whatever the reason, the fact is that being valued as a person is, well, you know, that it's absolutely critical to our being. And I think you're valued as a person when someone likes being with you without all too much palaver, or just be there. And that time spent, especially with little children, just admiring them must be absolute grace. But in a busy world, it's harder to do that. When mums and dads all have to work, I mean employed work away from the home and so on, it's not a lot harder. So, is it true or that to handle feelings that are difficult, we need to learn to live with them, suffer with them, and wait on a future moment where the darkness might dissolve? His second point, and again you have to just see if it makes sense to you, is that I have to learn and you have to learn and we have to teach others to accept appropriate responsibility. And this is very hard. For some temperaments, it's really hard. It's quite hard for me with my temperament. You might find it easier, I don't know. Accepting inappropriate responsibility strikes me as normal to my temperament. Taking blame where it shouldn't be, or thinking you can fix something up and it doesn't get fixed up, so you take responsibility. You know, all that trying to help and train to help and think you're supposed to be the helper. One day you have to wake up and realize who the hell you're, just an ordinary human being. But it's a temptation for all of us, I think, to feel responsible when things around us aren't going well. And in a way, it's just a dysfunctional behavior. But we have to accept inappropriate responsibility is part of the problem. What he calls a neurotic blaming of self. But I'm not the only one, I bet. How many of you mums and dads feel you're responsible for your children and what they do wrong, whether they come to Mass or not? It's your responsibility. How many of you wives or husbands feel you're responsible for the feelings of your partner? How many priests, and I've met this and this is a tragedy, how many priests feel responsible for what goes wrong in the parish? Really responsible for it. And that makes us all careful, it makes us all fearful, it makes us all super protective. And all of that, you know, is really not good. It's not trusting, it's not loving, but gee, to love your kids when they're in a cage and safe, and to open the cage yourself and see them fly off into this world with a hurricane blowing, can't be easy. Of course it's not easy. But they're actually birds and they're meant to fly. So what do? Keep them safe forever? Or watch them fly and see a falcon come down and... I don't know how you do it. But that's the pain of being a parent, I presume. And if you, in similar in all of our lives, we've got this, I'm not responsible for your feelings and you're not responsible for mine, and I have to leave them with you and suffer them while I can't solve them, because of course I can't solve them. But what I can do, and that's what this subject is about, I can love you while you suffer. That's terrific, isn't it? I mean, what a wonderful thing to do that. And you can love me while I suffer, but you can't take my suffering from me and you can't solve it for me. And you want to. So we have to learn to accept appropriate responsibility, or we'll always be getting in the road of love. Some people, on the other hand, another kind of temperament, I suppose, avoid appropriate responsibility. They don't. Some of us take on inappropriate, some just avoid it. It is your responsibility, it is mine, but we avoid, oh, it's someone else's problem. No worries. Everyone says that today. I found myself saying it the other day and I thought, oh God, talk about the corruption of society. No worries, you know, meaning yes or something. Well, avoiding appropriate responsibility, we do that. We can do that. We are responsible. We don't take it, accept it. So the conclusion he draws, and for our reflection, examination of conscience perhaps, I have to take responsibility for the choices I make. Haven't you ever done this? I see it a lot, so, and I probably do it sometimes too, but I certainly see it a lot, how people get angry and they say, you made me angry. To another person, you made me angry. Quite impossible, but I say it, or people say it. And they blame the other person for making them angry. And you just have to get out your Jung and open up page whatever and say, hey, have a look at this. When you did what you did, that person did something terrible to you, whoever it might be, you could have responded in 50 ways to that, couldn't you? There's all a whole range of possibilities of response. the fact that you responded that way, angrily, has got everything to do with you. The other person occasioned it, but why did you react angrily and not humorously or didn't care less? All the possibilities. If I respond any way to you, I've got to look in here to see why did I respond like that? And the answer is going to be found in here. But it's very common, isn't it, to blame the other person as though they did it, which makes us just like little puppets. Sometimes we can be like that in other people's. Our emotions are so involved that they can play our feelings. Kids are great at it. They know what stirs, they know what hooks, and they do it. And husbands can do it, and wives can do it, and the world can do it. But I can't allow that to happen, and I'll never learn to love peacefully and truthfully and authentically. Well, I will only learn to love authentically to the extent that I discover this truth and start to look in here and take responsibility for my own decisions and my own reactions and my own what's going on in here. It's a wonderfully liberating thing to do. It's very hard to do. But he suggests, I think rightly, that if we're going to learn to love, we have to learn to do this. Another matter that he suggests, if we're going to learn to love, is to be dedicated to the truth. This is a wonderful virtue. To want the truth at all costs. This is really very hard, very demanding, very simple, and very liberating. Because if you want the truth, you can't go wrong. And if we want the truth about ourselves, about another person, admitting the other person's not who they were, admitting our parents weren't saints, though we idealized them as young people, they were just human beings, beautiful, good, trying, mistaken, hurting, hurt, making the best of a hard life and all that, accepting all that's so important, isn't it? Just to liberate them from being blamed for the way they brought me up as a child or some blooming thing. And our husband is this and our wife is this and these are our kids and they're not the greatest kids in the world. Well, they are, but we're not comparing. So to be dedicated to the truth, recognizing that the truth is essential even for my own being, for real self-interest. Because the truth does set us free. Hard to find, but do you really want it? Do I want it? And what about when the truth is very uncomfortable? And very embarrassing and very humiliating. Do you really want it? Knowing that grace is in the truth and nowhere else? Fourthly, he suggests, how am I going? We've got 3 out of 3 so far. Fourthly, we need to be committed to discernment and balance. Knowing what to let go of and what to hold on to. I don't know how you get this, to be quite honest. When I was a boy of 13 and in the school, the priest used to believe in correcting us. Once a month he'd come in and give everybody a correction. I don't know where he got that idea. But anyway, he had it. He was a nice man, but a bit silly. I think that's truthful. But NEA told me, and this was true, but he said my problem was that I was scatterbrained. So I had to be more serious. So I went round being serious for about a week. And all my mates said, we liked you the way you were. Stopped. Well, you're not trying to be perfect. And then I thought, the kids are right, teacher's wrong. If I've got a scattered brain, what can you do with a scattered brain? I mean, that's all you've got, so you have to use it. So I decided to live with big scatterbrained. Here I am. So what do you let go of? What do you hold on to? Who are you? And you have to kind of learn to accept the limitations of the real and get on with life. he gives a list I'm about to give you of all the things that we have to let go in life. So if you're weeping in 5 minutes' time, well, that's what's happened. All the things we have to let go, and to let them go, and we don't all let them go at the right time. I'm still letting go stuff I should have let go when I was 18, probably. You know, you don't quite make it at the right time, and you just got to do it later. So, but letting go, all these things that we do need to let go, because when you're flying, you have to let go the view underneath. If you're a bird, I suppose, you have to let go the nest. You have to just move on. If you're a river, you might like the scenery, but you've got to move on to the sea. Well, and know that when you get unstuck from the moment, it's okay. It's okay for a river to go to the sea. It's okay to age. All of us in this room are actually in the best age we could possibly be in. There's no better age than the one you and I have got. And if you've got a few wrinkles to show for it, they're your character. You don't have to do what the TV stars do, try and pretend they're not there, because that's all the love you've ever given is on your face. And all the anger's there too, of course. How am I going? I better just see if I can. But so live with it. And it's actually the best face you could have. So living as we are and growing as we are, that's who we are. And it's where we are that we're graced. And if God wants you to love another person, he wants you to love the other person. And he'll grace you to love the other person. Not the woman or man you would have been if you had have had different parents, or if your brother hadn't hung you from the tree for an hour when you were a kid and left you with your hair all over the place, or if you hadn't been bashed by some Missionary of the Sacred Heart teacher in a secondary school. No, you, this actual human being sitting or standing right here, you're the one who is graced to love, the real you. Who are you? I don't remember having half these, but you might have had them all or some of them, and each one take your own temperament. First thing he reckons we've got to let go. Well, we won't worry about first or second. Just run through the list and think of them and just examine your conscience from it and see how you're going. The state of infancy in which no external demands need to be responded to. You're the centre of everyone's attention. You were the most beautiful baby ever born into this world. That's what they told you. Mum said it, Dad said it, Uncle said it, the priest said it. Everyone around you thought you were an absolutely gorgeous darling. Of course, they're right, but that's a nice feeling, I imagine, to have that happening. Have this, all these adults just looking at you, thinking you're wonderful. Well, you are. But that has to be let go a bit, doesn't it? In the real world we're in, we have to kind of grow up from there, remembering that admiration, but realizing we're not actually the center of the world. And there are responses that are needed. I can't wait for everything to come to me. Why don't the world owes me a living? The fantasy of omnipotence. Not quite sure what that is, but you might know, so let me know later if you fancy the fantasy of omnipotence. I've got a bit of it as a priest, but I don't know that I had it as a boy. But anyhow, whatever. The desire for total possession of one's parents. I can't say anything about that. I was the seventh of eight kids and I never had total possession of my parents, so I don't recall it being a feeling. But for some it might be. For you it might be. The dependency of childhood. That's a big thing. I think some women are very dependent on their husband and on being the wife of somebody. I've seen people in marriage situations that they didn't let go when they should have, because they couldn't bear the thought of being alone. And I'm sure you've seen that. Some of you may even experience that. that lack of sense of self and always having depended, how do you let that go? And they say you can't learn to really love till you let it go. Distorted images of one's parents have to be let go. The omnipotentiality, whatever that is, of adolescence. Well, I think a lot of adolescents experience that. They know everything. Here's a good one. The freedom of being uncommitted. Most of us are forced out of that. The agility of youth, I'll run over that quickly. The sexual attractiveness and potency of youth. I don't know what that is because I left home when I was 13 and was locked away in a seminary, so didn't know whether I had it or didn't have it. But anyhow, no chance to find out. So, but anyhow, that's life. The fantasy of immortality. Now let's get a bit closer to us. Authority over one's children. Do you know anyone who won't let their kids go? Don't blush, but I mean, do you know anyone else who won't let their kids go? Authority over one's children must be hard. The independence of physical health and ultimately this extraordinary mystery of letting go of life itself. That's an enormous battle, I imagine. Though I had the pleasure of seeing both my mother die and one of my brothers die and being with them while they died. And in their case, they did this beautifully. So it's great. It doesn't mean I will be able to, but isn't it nice to have an example of someone who let go life? I don't mean glad to die, but I mean with dignity and beauty. It's a great mental image that gives me something to think about when my time comes. And you've probably had that experience too. But it's a big thing to do, to let it go. And he's saying, and I won't labour it anymore, to learn to love, I have to learn to let go what is gone. What's going and what's gone. Not hold on to earlier things that are actually stopping me be me and live in the present moment and accept the whole reality of my very fragile, limited, sinful, broken, struggling, loving life. Because I'm the one. I am the one that's graced to love now. Wherever I've been, whatever's happened, whoever I've lost, I am who I am, and I haven't lost anything real. I might have lost, well, that's a silly thing to say, because we do lose things that are real. But what was real remains is, I think, what I want to say. We believe in death is not the end of life, so a parent lost is still present. And if the parent has died, or the spouse, or the child, a lot of pain in all that, then I just had a little memory I'll share with you. You know, might as well, just came to me. I knew this girl really well at university, lovely woman, and she married. And this doesn't happen too often, I don't think. But she took her child right to term, and the child was born dead. God, it was painful. Painful for me, for heaven's sake, and for her and for her husband. But, you know, it was just so painful. And they asked me to do the funeral. And, you know, little coffin. Oh, God, I was in a mess. They were in a mess. Everyone. I mean, it's too much for anyone to have to witness such things. And yet here there was this little child, and we looked into the coffin, perfect little beautiful baby, but born dead. I can't even imagine what that would have been like to the mother. But, and it just came to me then as I'm talking to you, but I remember in the sermon, or whatever you call it, well, I was perhaps inspired, whatever the word is, but I remember saying anyhow, and I'm talking about 20 years ago, and I hope this was truthful, at least it was received by her as such, that the gift of that child for 9 months, like the child is dead. But somehow, I can't find the words now, I managed to focus on those 9 months of dreaming and hoping and loving and sharing and intimacy. And whatever the words were, and you mothers might understand this, or you mightn't, or it might not even be, but the mother, it changed her view of the loss, and I think beautifully, because you can look at the loss, can't you, or you can look at the gift, and you think of the people in your life that you've lost, but what a gift to have had them, to lose them, and they're not lost. Falling in love is not love. And we've all lived long enough to know that, but I'll just say it because it's here. Falling in love, he says, is a sex-linked erotic response. He defines it, you check whether it's true or not, as a genetically determined instinctual component of mating behaviour. That's a bit rough, isn't it? But putting it out there in probably clear words, if it is correct, are helpful. That's what it is. It's a nice feeling, and it's obviously important. He says, he's a psychiatrist, you tell me if he's right or wrong, but he says it's a partial and temporary collapse of our ego boundaries. And that's what we like about it. It's actually a reversion, falling in love, I mean, it's a reversion back to being a child. A child, he suggests, gradually acquires boundaries very slowly. You find yourself independent of mum and independent of dad and independent of your brothers and sisters. You find your separation, you gradually work out something of yourself, your identity, and this means loneliness. It's nice to be in your mother's womb, I presume. It's nice to be so intimately close to someone that you're part of. Well, separation's painful for mum and for child. But it's a necessary journey, and a painful one, but a real one. Now, he suggests that when you fall in love with someone, it's like you can let all those boundaries go again and feel communion and feel love and feel loved and just feel one with. And it's a great feeling, but it's actually real but temporary, and it can't last. Reality, he suggests, intrudes. And those of you who are married will surely know this. And you have to face the truth that this man, this woman, this other person, that you're not one at all, you're still two. The boundaries have to return because they're real. Your thinking's different, your feelings are different, your opinions are different. And so they're not setting up boundaries, but they're recognizing the loneliness that we are alone. I am alone in this world. Now, I can be alone loving you, or I can be alone without loving you. And it's much better to love when you're alone. But I am alone, and you're alone in a very real sense, where you're nobody else and nobody else is you. And existentially, that's an extraordinary thing to say in such a big, big world, but it's true. And then he goes on, he says it's true, I think it's true. He says that when we fall out of love, and we undoubtedly do fall out of love in that sense of falling in love and out of love, that feeling of falling goes with reality and with... We've got two choices. If we don't let this go, we'll think, oh, I made a heck of a mistake. I better find someone else that I can have this feeling with because the feeling's gone. And then you can be looking around desperately for someone else whom you can revert to childhood with. Or, having fallen out of love, we can then actually begin the real work of loving. We can begin with some feeling, with a lot of memory, to begin love. He makes a second point that might help you, or help me in our reflections. He says dependency isn't love. He says, check yourself about this, that passive-dependent personality disorder, he's speaking as a psychiatrist here, a passive-dependent personality disorder is perhaps the most common of all psychiatric disorders. So it's likely a lot of us suffer from it to some degree. And if we do, it will be a barrier to love. That's why we're talking about it. It defines it as unable to experience wholeness or function adequately without the certainty of being actually cared for by another. My whole identity is in relation to this person or this situation, and I can't imagine living without it. Well, that hooks me right into it and makes me terrifically vulnerable to all kinds of oppression and abuse and use and all the rest of it, and infantilism and so on. But it's common. We're talking about an ordinary human disorder, and it takes a lot of courage, as I'm sure many of you know, to recognize this and to be helped to take steps to avoid it, because it's actually not true. Well, I didn't notice the word, but he says it there. It nourishes infantilism rather than growth. It works to trap and constrict rather than liberate. Can be mutually reinforcing in unliberating relationships where everything is done to secure what the other will do for me. We become manipulative, we'll do anything, we'll work really hard for other people. As a parish priest, you'll do everything for the people so that they'll like you. You can see, I'm sure, that that's wrong and it won't work. But it's not easy to not avoid. And we will be, a wife or a husband will be working, but doing things in order to retain the affection of the spouse. Not game to be yourself. Not free to be yourself. Trusting that if I am myself, the spouse may leave me. But he may stay or she may stay and love me. But you've got no choice but to be yourself. So how much courage do we need to do that? How much trust do we do? And where are we going to get the strength to do it? And we need to do that. And if we don't do it, it'll always hurt our loving, whatever state of life we're in. And here he moves, I think, closer to the centre of our topic, where he says, love that falls short of spiritual growth is not love. I'm sure I spent a heck of a lot of my priestly life loving people, inverted commas, as best I could, but not sufficiently aware of this. Because to love someone for their spiritual growth will often require not being there, won't it? Stepping back, not loving. It'll require a lot of creation of distance even. All of which feels, get back to the feelings, awkward and not very comforting and not very, but that's all part of real loving. He says the only true goal or end of love is spiritual growth, meaning the other person becoming, we're getting close to love now, what the other person is capable of being, even if it means without me. Of course, and I might be the mother or father or friend. But to really want this person to be as beautiful, as free, as caring, as loving as that person can be without engaging myself or yourself into that thing and being bound into it in a dependency relationship or whatever it might be, ego boosting it could be, all those things are possible. That's love. And that's very mature stuff. This is an image here which I just put quickly, but gee, you see it enough on TV, anyhow, if not in your own life. Affection for pets. And it's beautiful to see people with little dog. I don't have them, but we're not talking about having pets, but to treat people as pets. And listen to the language of love on the TV programs. Pet. baby. Baby with American accent. And what's all that rubbish about? I mean, I think you just have to call it rubbish. And hiding underneath it are all kinds of vices of control. And yet it's the baby thing. But we're not babies. It falls short of self-giving in view of the other's real growth. Do you want the person that you love to be as free and as mature and as independent and as fulfilled as they can be? Do you really want that? Want them hooked to you for your own security? He makes another, I think, telling point that may help you, help me. Self-sacrifice is not love. How many men or women do you know who live very self-sacrificing lives, but it's not productive and it's not working, and they can't stop it? Because they see themselves as givers. The motives behind injudicious giving and destructive nurturing are many. But such cases invariably have a basic feature in common. You check if it's right. The giver, under the guise of love, is responding to and meeting his or her own needs without regard to the spiritual needs of the one receiving. It looks like love. It looks like care. But it's possessiveness. It's control, it's wanting an identity that we can't let go. None of this is, all this is forgivable. God help us, we're all in this, I imagine, except those of you who are particularly mature. We're caught in a lot of this, but I think recognizing it might be of value. As long as we have help to grow beyond it. He gives an example. We might maintain the self-image as a compassionate person, so we don't confront. Religious life, by the way, for those of you who aren't in religious life, is full of this. Absolutely full of it. Well, I'm speaking of myself as much as anybody else. Because we're trained to be nice to people, you know. I think in marriages it's less full of it, I think, because you almost have to get on with it. So life demands a lot of truth and anger and letting it out, I think. Might be I'm idealizing marriage, but wherever I've seen married people, they usually call a spade and get on with it. But in religious life, you call a spade something else, really, because it's kind of nicer to talk about it like some other way, a bit. I don't want to put us down, but I think I recognize it. And confronting is very hard, because, you see, in my own religious order, like, I don't have to confront. Do you know what I mean? And as a man living on my own without a wife or kids, I don't actually have to confront. I can go to bed and wait. Or say something nice and... I hope I'm explaining myself clearly. I don't know if I am. But if you don't have to confront, I think we probably tend not to. Because it's so hard. It's the feelings are so bad. But when you just have to, you get on with it and you learn how to do it. So I would say I'm quite bad at this, and everyone around me seems to be worse. So, like, we're not so good at it. And when someone can do it, and I don't mean confront, just letting off, mouthing off, thank God that doesn't happen, because people are trained to be more gentle than that. But gentleness can become a cover for lack of truth or for lack of courage. And to have the ability to confront, and of course it's an art too, to confront with love and with care, because you think and know the truth is the main thing, and to be ready to forgive and love and follow on something, that's hard but always productive. I think perhaps I've overstated that, but some truth in that. If you have a self-image as being a compassionate, kind person, which most of us are trained to and perhaps are, it's very difficult to confront and call it kind. Just give me a bit of a help. Do you know what I'm trying to say awkwardly? At least I find it. Maybe I'm just telling you I find it difficult, but I don't think I'm the only one. I think it's, whereas confronting can be very kind, can't it? Because then the person knows if you say something truth complimentary that it's real. If everything you say is a compliment, either they're a saint or you're blind. I find that anyhow. If someone can call what's wrong in me and then say something beautiful, I feel good. Because I feel loved and it's real. But not easy to get to that. This next one I'll just say quickly, though it is a common enough thing in life. Seeking to be maltreated to enjoy the feeling of being superior and humiliating the other. That's a trap that you see in relationships. You're the martyr. I'm always at home, I'm always doing this, and look, you're out there. And the other person gets into a corner where there's no way out, and you're always feeling the superior person because of your fidelity and loyalty and goodness and go through the list, but you're not being truthful. He doesn't say this, but I wanted to say it, so I'm putting it here. He says self-sacrifice is not love. There is another sense in which self-sacrifice is, of course. The word sacrifice is the problem. Its normal meaning is the way he uses it, but that's not its real meaning. The word sacrifice means to make holy or sacred. From the two Latin words, sacer, which is sacred, and facere or facere, meaning to make. Sacrifice is something made holy, something placed into the presence of God, something in communion with God. So self-sacrifice, literally, and what a beautiful meaning this is allowing oneself to be surrounded by the love of God and to live in that love. Well, that is wonderful stuff. That's the goal of life. As long as I suggest there, it means sacrifice of the self and not by the self. Of oneself to let God determine what happens. St. Ignatius we had the other day, Lord, accept my liberty, my understanding. That's letting everything in the hands of God so that God can inspire us to do anything God wants, just to be an open channel of grace, is a wonderful gift and sacrifice and truth. And Jesus said, if you seek yourself, well, you'll lose it. If you give yourself, sacrifice yourself, you'll find yourself. I'll just conclude. Just some quotations from the author that I'm quoting. And then I'll leave you to read the Carthusian if you want to for yourself. Love is, he says, the will to extend one's self for the purpose of nurturing one's own and another's spiritual growth. And by that he means, I think, sensitivity to the action of God in this mysterious human being. My wife, my child, my parent. And God is loving this person. God is inspiring this other person. God is nurturing this other person. The Spirit of God has been poured into this other person. They may be blind to it, careless of it, neglectful of it and all that. But it's all happening. Now, when I enter that person's life, when you enter my life, or me, yours, we have to be so aware of the sacred and allow all that to go on and watch for it. And if I'm watching for that and you're watching for it and we're sensitive to it and believe in it, we don't have to get involved to solve it. God's involved to solve it. We have to be ready, however, to love, to be there with the other person without taking over their life and enjoy their growth or trust their growth or pray for their growth or just love them in it, even if they're making mistakes. I think that's something of what it means to extend myself, to really care for you, for the real you, who is a mystery to me, and you do it for me, and we do it for each other. He goes on, whenever we think of ourselves as doing something for somebody else, Simone Weil wrote a wonderful book called, I thought it was wonderful, she's a, well, Jewish really, but Christian mentally, French philosopher, woman, fought in the Spanish Civil War and died not long after. And she says, I haven't distracted myself too much by telling you those details. She says, if you don't have to love somebody, don't. It's an exaggerated statement, but my heck, there's a lot of good truth in it. If you don't have to love, don't. I'll let you ponder that as I'm pondering it. It's kind of, I think it's immensely wise, but not quite, you know, it's a paradox. Because if you love me, and it's an effort, how do you think I feel? Because it shows, doesn't it? It's a real effort for you to love me, but you're being very good loving me. Well, thanks all the same, I could do without that. Because I feel the effort, and you're really, we're building our own ego in a way. But if you can't not love me, oh, that's bloody nice, I love that. Because I don't mean just from your feelings, I mean from your spirit and from your faith and from your awareness of God. If you come gently to me, and but you love me just because I'm there, and I love you because of that. I don't really just mean just from native feeling, but from faith. Then that kind of love comes across so graciously and so powerfully and so beautifully and so simply that it always does good. And I think I've experienced this in my life. I'm sure I have in some way, and I've certainly seen it a lot in other people. That we have to, if I'm not ready yet to love you, you're in need, let's say, and I'm not ready yet to love you, I should wait till I am before I do anything. Because who the heck am I anyhow? And isn't that the story in the parables of Jesus, of the Good Samaritan? The priest went by on the other side. He saw him and went by on the other side. We did this last week, didn't we? Last month. And then the Levite saw him and went by on the other side. The Samaritan saw him, was moved with compassion, and went up and bathed his wounds and took him to the inn. So, what do you think of the idea of when you see someone's in need and you notice it, that's wonderful. All those three people noticed the need, that's the start. What do you think of the idea of waiting till you are moved with compassion before you do anything? And if you're not moved with compassion, maybe you're intruding. And maybe you're doing it for your own good and not for the other person's good. And while you're waiting to be moved with compassion, maybe your heart is deepening to be able to really love. I don't know what I'm saying is true, and you know I don't know. I'm just putting it out as an idea, because actually life doesn't seem to be as clear-cut as all that. But I'm convinced that there's a value there somewhere in the middle of all that. And I certainly see other people doing a lot of loving things reluctantly, and it's not working because it's not really love. It's the inability of the giver to stop giving, but it's not real love for that other person. And to say no would be hard, or to do nothing would be hard, but probably truthful, and hopefully, if grace comes, if I can't do anything for you or you can't do anything for me, the time might come when my heart is moved and then I might say something or do something and it'll be very beautiful because it'll be from God, not from my own need to respond. And you're back to Scott Peck. we do is done because we choose to do it. And we make that choice because it is the one that satisfies us most. It fulfills a need we all have. I think it's true for me. You check yourself. I think there's more pleasure in giving than receiving. There's more pleasure in loving almost than there is in being loved. And I think that actually makes sense spiritually too, because God is love. Like when you're actually the one loving, you're in a way like God. I mean, you're something beautiful is coming through you to the other person. When you're allowing the other person to love you, you're giving them a wonderful gift, aren't you? You're allowing them to be like God. You're accepting your need for their love. You're allowing them to grow because they're loving you. And that's a lesson that in my training wasn't given, or I didn't receive it, let me put it that way. We were trained to love others, and I find it probably still, but certainly used to find it enormously, I suppose I didn't bother with it or something, but you kind of saw myself probably as the one giving love to the people, you know. But you try and love me and you'd soon find me ducking for cover. And that's bad. I didn't know then. But it is because, well, you'd know why it is. To allow another person to love you is to give them a beautiful gift, clearly. And you just reflect on how much joy you get in giving love and you'll know the answer to that. It's true, he says, that love involves a change in the self. But this is an extension of the self. Genuine love is self-replenishing activity. Meet someone who enjoys doing what they do, and don't you enjoy them enjoying it? Like that. And if someone loves you and enjoys it, that's wonderful stuff. We've already been through that. If they love you and don't enjoy it, what's that telling you about yourself? I think they would be better, we would be better, to not do anything than to do that. And have to face the poverty of our loving, the poverty of our compassion, our inability to react, and work through all those feelings, rather than bypass them by doing good that isn't good. Because we can't bear the silence or the stillness. He goes on, indeed, it's even more. It enlarges rather than diminishes the self. It fills the self rather than depleting it. In a real sense, he says, love is as selfish as non-love. He means selfish in a good sense there, but it's not selfishness or unselfishness that distinguishes love from not love. It's the aim of what we're doing. In the case of genuine love, the aim is always spiritual growth. Growth in the spirit. Growth in freedom. Growth in communion with life and love and the world and all those lovely things we want to see other people get. We don't want to hook them to us. We want to liberate them to live. And if liberated to live, they love us, then that's a wonderful gift. But anything else isn't wonderful because we've hooked them so they've got to love us. Well, what's in that? No future, it just keeps spinning around and we know it. Whereas if you open the cage and let the bird fly and it comes back, isn't that a joy? A joy you mightn't get because they might fly away. That's the risk that we take. But they might, having flown, come back. And that's overwhelmingly a gift. God does that to us. The Father did it to the prodigal son. We have to do it to our children, to our husband, to our wife, to anyone around us. And when you do let someone be themselves and be free, and they don't come back, that's very painful. When you do let them be themselves and they come back, that's the essence of love. Let you pray for a while if you can find anything to pray in and all that. Spend time now with Jesus who loved so beautifully. And maybe Scott Peck does have some hints that might help me and help you in the psychological grounding of this great art to which we're all called, the art of loving.